It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, picking the right cut of steak is almost as important as how we cook it. We'll talk with the newest member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame about what to keep in mind. First, Wisconsin's educational outcome gap between black and white students is one of the largest in the nation. According to some recent research, one thing that contributes to that problem is the lack of racial and ethnic diversity in the state's teacher workforce. While student diversity has grown, Wisconsin's teachers have been 95% white for the last decade. We're talking about a new Wisconsin Policy Forum report on the lack of diversity among Wisconsin teachers and educational inequality in the state as a whole. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher or student of color in Wisconsin? Did you grow up going to Wisconsin schools? What has your experience been like? For anyone who's going to a school, just graduated, a parent, a staff at school, do you see efforts in your district to try to recruit a more diverse teaching workforce? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. James Causey is an editorial writer for the Ideas Lab of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, you reviewed this Wisconsin Policy Forum report and did some reporting on this, of course, on the side. Looking at these reports from the Policy Forum, first of all, what do the numbers show us about diversity or lack of diversity in our teacher workforce?
Well, the numbers were not really surprising to me. It really shows a lack of diversity. I mean, roughly in the state, 95% of the teachers are white compared to other races. And, you know, when you look at it, you know, students of color are not seeing themselves or not being taught by people who look like them. And that's a major problem, because we know that studies show that when a student of color, especially a black student, has a black teacher, it increases their graduation rate and also increases the chances for them going on to college.
Can you talk a little more about why it's important for students to see teachers who look like them? Because I think some people listening might say, hey, a teacher is a teacher. They're a good teacher. This shouldn't matter. What would you say to that?
Well, if you think about it, if 95% of the teachers are white and for white students, that works out fine. But I think when we talk about teachers of color, especially black teachers, black male teachers, most of us don't ever have a black male teacher. And we live in a nation where we need to see people of all kinds. I mean, we just function better. And not one thing that a black teacher provides for a school and for a classroom is not just an increase in academics for a black student. It increases academics for white students as well. So, I mean, when we think about all the things that we could do to boost education, you know, we're always changing reading programs and things like that, and we get a little bit of a jump or a bump. Why not go to something that research has proven that works, and that's having more teachers of color, because it helps you to see someone who looks like you teaching.
Talking to James Causey with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab, looking at diversity and lack of diversity in Wisconsin's teacher workforce. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, in your reporting on this, you focus in on a black man who teaches in Milwaukee, and his story illustrates a lot of the obstacles that that schools have in finding black teachers, black potential teachers have in becoming teachers. Can you tell us a little bit about Jarvis Ragland?
Yeah, Jarvis Ragland is a type of teacher that I think districts all across the state should really be trying to find. He was a guy who got into teaching really late. He's 30 years old now. His mother was a teacher, a longtime teacher, and he never really thought about going into the profession until his mother encouraged him to become a paraprofessional, someone who works inside of a classroom under a teacher. After spending time doing that, he said, yeah, you know, I think this is something I would like to give a try to. So his first full year of teaching, he experienced it all. He was given students who had a lot of behavioral problems. It was like 6 to 8 students in his class, but he had to deal with these kids, and most of them were black boys at the school. And, you know, he struggled at first really trying to gain their confidence. you know, he had some good days and bad days. And then next thing you know, they transferred him to a different school because of politics. They had to reduce them. They didn't have enough students in the behavioral classes, so they had to reduce the class, and he had the least seniority, so they moved him over to a different school. So right after he started to get this really good bond with these students, where they started to trust him and refer to him as their big brother, he was transferred to a different school. Right after that happened, the pandemic hit, right? So now he's dealing with the pandemic, but and he's trying to acclimate himself to this new school. And so he's working with these new students, but at the same time, he didn't want to give up on the students that he developed this bond with. So he maintained a relationship with those kids, calling them, checking in on them, checking in on their parents as well. And that's something that going above and beyond is something that we really want our teachers to do. And he did all of that, and he succeeded at that.
Can you talk about some of the points along the pipeline from being that high school student yourself to becoming a teacher that a lot of Black potential teachers face that may lead them out of the profession?
Yeah. So basically what we have is a pipeline problem. You know, when you think about how many people could actually go into the teaching business, if we really want to get more teachers of color, it's just really a pipeline problem. From graduation to going to college to those students in college choosing teaching as a profession to those people potentially staying in the state and teaching. Every single time that number drops tremendously. So by the time we get to teachers who could actually teach, who are teachers of color, it's like 6% that could actually go into the classroom. And then we have this other problem that comes up. Most of the teachers who start teaching, we lose half of them by the time, you know, within the first 3 or 4 years. So it's like starting all over, and you're starting with a smaller and smaller pool. So what we have to start doing is finding ways to get more kids into the pipeline in the first place, and then keeping them in the pipeline. So a lot of that comes with making sure that they have good mentors when they're in college. And when they decide to go into teaching. So we have to provide them and surround them with the services that they need so they don't leave the profession, because it really takes roughly like 3 or 4 years for a teacher to really get their bearings and really become really solid teachers. And so it's steps along the way that we have to really work to do that. And talking up the teaching profession is one of them. I mean, it starts with, you know, talking about how great teachers are. You know, I mean, we've all had good and bad teachers, right? So, but we all had those good and bad experiences. But the best teachers we had, most of us developed lifelong relationships with those teachers. We still remember them. So it's important for the teaching profession to really highlight those great teachers as well.
In your piece, you share the story of a couple teachers you worked with as a student yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I was educated in Milwaukee public schools, K-12. I went to Marquette University for 4.5 years and graduated. And I went to graduate school to get my MBA at Cardinal Stritch for 2.5 years. And then all that time, I only had one Black male teacher and one Black female teacher. That's a lot of education in the state or in the city and not coming across Black teachers. But I still remember the two teachers I had. Miss Reed was my fourth grade teacher. She lived in the neighborhood. She sort of reminded me a lot of my mother. She would, if I disappointed her, she would stop over at the house and have a conversation with me and my parents. And my next Black teacher was Mr. Jackson, and I didn't have him until Spanish in 10th grade. Had I not taken Spanish, I would have never had a Black male teacher. That says a lot. That tells you all you need to know. And a lot of people that I talk to who I work with, they never had any Black male teachers. Very few even had Black female teachers. And I think when you think about that and you think about how we know that diversity really matters and it really plays an important role, if you don't have that foundation of actually seeing someone in a classroom teaching who's a person of color, that says a lot about how you probably think about the teaching profession.
We're talking about diversity and lack of diversity in Wisconsin's teacher workforce. James Causey is an editorial writer for the Ideas Lab of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote about this issue recently, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions, maybe your experiences. What do you think could be done to increase educational equality and outcomes around the state? What do students of color need that they don't have access to? What do you think needs to be done to get more people from more different backgrounds into teaching? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist James Causey with the Ideas Lab there about the lack of diversity in Wisconsin's teacher workforce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do things look like in schools in your community? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Matt is with us in Iowa County. Matt, hi.
Hi. Hi. I grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin, and through my education, I had one African-American teacher who was an industrial arts teacher in eighth grade, and he was one of the best teachers I ever had, and I always wish we had.
Oh, Matt, your call is coming in and out. Thanks, Matt, sharing the experience of having at least exactly, it sounds like, one black teacher along the way. And Matt passed along to our producer before we get on. He wants to see government school districts prioritize this and address the pipeline problems. James, a couple thoughts. Are there any experiments out there that are showing promise? People have been talking about this for a while now.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of things that a lot of people don't view it as a serious problem, but it really is. So, you know, a couple of things that the Wisconsin Policy Forum put out there is, you know, first, they believe that there should be maybe some financial incentives and assistance for teachers of color, like maybe scholarships and loan forgiveness. That could be a way to keep people in the pipeline if they know that if they stay in the teaching field, that their loans would be forgiven. You know, maybe provide a higher salary for teachers of color who teach in high poverty districts, in high poverty classrooms. That should also help as well. And then, you know, one thing that they could start doing is looking for mentors and really making sure that mentors work with the teachers from the very beginning and not wait until they develop problems. Because usually by the time a teacher of color has problems with a school, it's too late. So really making sure that they have mentors from the very beginning is important. But one thing I want to stress, I'm not saying, and the Wisconsin Policy Forum is not saying that white teachers are bad. And I don't want that to come across like that. What they're saying is that we could do a better job. And there are studies out there that prove that teachers of color provide something that our students, all of our students, are not getting right now.
Thanks for that call. Sorry we lost your connection there. Let's go to David now in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hello.
Hi, thank you. You know, I think of teaching like coaching. So I was thinking like NBA, NFL, where they're predominantly black athletes and predominantly white coaches slash teachers. And in that case, I feel like white coaches are successful. So I guess I'm not quite following the need for same color teachers. If a student works hard, the one that works harder, I think would do better than their peers that maybe don't work as hard. So I don't quite understand that.
David, thanks for the call. What do you think of the analogy, James, between, a pro sports team and the classroom?
Well, let me explain it in a different way. One thing that makes Jarvis Ragland so different than other teachers that he worked with is that he comes from the same neighborhood that a lot of his students come from. So there's not this learning curve as to dealing with kids' trauma. Like if a kid sees something or sees something violent or experience something bad in his neighborhood, Jarvis kind of knows about it because he's from this area as well. So he's experienced a lot of the pain and traumas that these kids have experienced. And he's able to really truly understand that better than a teacher who probably doesn't live in the district anymore. And that's another issue that we could talk about. A lot of our teachers are not, they may be Milwaukee public school teachers, but they live outside of Milwaukee now. So it's hard for them to actually understand because they're not living in the area that they're closest to. So, Jarvis doesn't have that learning curve because he's experiencing what the kids have experienced, and he's able to help them identify with that and understand it. And honestly, if we really want to be real and talking about this, I'm in a lot of white spaces, right? As a reporter, where I go to events, and usually I'm the only one there. I'm one of a few Black reporters that's actually in the newsroom and newsrooms across this country. And one thing that I know I do, I tend to gravitate to people who kind of look like me. There's studies out that talks about how, you know, people of color tend to gravitate to people who look like them, especially when they're in spaces like that. So is when it comes to young people and people of color, especially Black boys, our Black boys need to see people who look like them doing this job. And it's a recruiting tool as well. If I have like Mr. Jackson, seeing Mr. Jackson as a teacher, that's something great for me to see as a Black man, seeing another Black man teaching Spanish that I even considered teaching at one time. So I think that's also a recruiting tool, and that could also help get more kids and keep more people of color in the pipeline as well.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to James Causey from the Idea Lab at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a lack of diversity in Wisconsin's teachers' workforce, why it matters, and some possible solutions. James, one thing you point out in your reporting that I hadn't thought of before is sometimes that Black teacher, especially the Black man who's a teacher, like Jarvis Ragland we were talking about earlier, they get extra work because people say, hey, maybe this is the person who can deal with these students who are having trouble. Even if they're not in his class or they're not part of his assignment to deal with, maybe they can help. So it's well-meaning, but it's an extra workload on those teachers.
Oh yeah. And that's one of those things that's not written on the, when you sign up for the job, it's not stated on the job, but you take on that extra responsibility. And a lot of teachers of color take on that extra responsibility. So, you know, I had a chance to see it in person. You know, I spent a couple of days with Jarvis in school, and I saw how the other students looked up to him and how the students of color actually looked up to him and tried to model his behavior from the way he walked, from the way he carried himself, because he carried himself very professional, you know, from the way he talked and those kind of things. They tried to emulate that and be like that because they really respected him. And it's power in seeing people who look like you do the job. And it may be anecdotal, but it's very powerful to see it. So yeah, one thing that teachers of color often run into, especially when they're Black males, is they have to be the disciplinarian most of the time because, you know, let's face it, a male's voice sounds different than a female's voice, especially when it comes to that discipline. And so when these boys hear that, and some of them don't have their fathers in their homes with them, they listen to it a lot more than they do if it was a white woman saying something like that to them. And it's power in that. But should Jarvis, because he's a Black male, have these added responsibilities? I mean, it's a lot of work. I think he's doing, you know, when he got transferred to a different school, a lot of teachers would have just said, well, those are other kids' students now. But he didn't do that because he felt this extra responsibility to maintain his connection with his former students.
You mentioned the difficulties sometimes of having teachers from outside the community they're working in. And I think you briefly touched on this earlier, and I know you wrote about it. Could you talk about the idea of you're starting in high school and saying, okay, can we start recruiting these future teachers in our high school, in our community, with the hopes that they end up teaching back here in their, you know, welcome back Cotter. They come back to the school, the disabled school that they came out of.
Yeah. Just imagine how great that would be. And I've actually come across teachers in my years of reporting who are, they're working in the schools that they graduated from. You know, I went to Samuel Clemens Elementary School, which is right down the street from me. And there's several teachers of color who teach there, who graduated from there. So you don't think there's power in that, and they still live in the neighborhood? It's some power in that. They get to see the students that they teach in the neighborhood, and the students get to see them. The parents get to see them. It's some power in that. I just think that, you know, just like with the police department, when police officers tend to start leaving neighborhoods because they don't have to live here, they could live in Mequon or Whitefish Bay or outside of Milwaukee and still come in to police, I think you lose something. I think you lose that value of like, I'm a part of this community. Some people will argue against that, but it's something to be said for being closer to an issue or a problem than being further away from it. And I tend to agree that the closer you are to something, the better that you can address it.
Do you see progress being made, James? I know we've been having similar conversations about outcome gaps over the years for a long time now.
Do I see progress? Not really. I think what we're seeing, like what school districts tend to do, they cannibalize each other. You know, a Black teacher may leave one Black school and go to another, but they're not doing a better job at really getting more teachers into the pipeline. And that's where the state comes in. The state needs to find a way to think outside the box when it comes to teaching. You know, one thing that we know is when it comes to the reading test and that part for teachers, Black teachers don't do as well. And it's some reasons behind that. And I'm not exactly sure they're still studying that. But what we're finding is that even though Black teachers may do worse on the reading and math part to become teachers, it doesn't affect how they teach in their effectiveness in the classroom. So maybe one thing we could do is waive some of those tests, because they do it for special education. So maybe they should do it for regular teachers. Another thing, like I said, they really come up with ways to make sure that teachers want to stay in a profession. So mentorship is important, as well as loan forgiveness. You know, we've seen a lot of this happen when nurses were during the pandemic, when they waived some student loans for nurses and people like that going into the profession. We have a crisis right now where we have to get more teachers of color into the pipeline. So I think everything should be on the table, from loan forgiveness to mentorship to even recruiting people who like Jarvis, who didn't pick teaching as a profession at first, and looking for people who may consider it as a secondary part of their education.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
That's James Causey, editorial writer for the Ideas Lab of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us for a look at the lack of diversity in Wisconsin's teacher workforce, the problems that can cause, and some possible solutions. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll find out what to know about different cuts of steak and how to grill them just right every time. So if you're looking for that special grill-out steak meal, stay tuned. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, it's the State Capitol Report. Get the latest on the state budget process with plans for tax changes, education funding, and lots more. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday, and this week Meathead is back with us to talk about steak. Maybe you've settled on cooking steaks this weekend. You've got the grill out. What kind? What cut do you go with? Ribeye, sirloin, tenderloin, flank, skirt? A lot to choose from. It can be confusing, but with some advice, we can get the best possible results out of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how to pick out and cook some steak on the grill? Do you have a go-to cut that you really enjoy? Do you have a magical secret to share? Won't be a secret anymore, but you can still share it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Meathead Goldwyn is the founder of AmazingRibs.com, author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. He's also the latest inductee to the Barbecue Hall of Fame. Meathead, good to have you back.
Oh, always good talking to you, Rob.
Is it going
to be steak on Sunday for Dad's Day for you?
I know. Other people are going to make food for me, and I'm the only who grills here. So the grill will not be fired up without my participation. Meathead, before we get to those steaks, I want to congratulate you. You're actually officially inducted later this year.
It's quite an honor. There are only 26 living members of the Barbecue Hall of Fame, and I am going in with a pretty august class. Ollie Gates from Gates Barbecue in Kansas City, and Arthur Bryant also in Kansas City. The two pillars of great barbecue in Kansas City are going in with me. And Rodney Scott, the pillar of Charleston barbecue. So it's quite an honor. I'm quite thrilled.
Well, fantastic. Well, let's get some of that Hall of Fame style advice from you now, Meathead. Now, first of all, I'll eat steak. I'm a little intimidated by picking it because I don't know which cut should I get. If I buy the good stuff, am I going to murder it on the grill? could you first sort out when we're at the meat counter or the butcher or whatever, what we're looking at, what we want to pick out, especially for that super fancy steak if we're really looking to splurge this week?
Well, as with any cooking, indoors, outdoors, any ingredient, it starts with quality. You need to buy a quality piece of meat. You can't make a bad steak into a good steak. You can make a good steak into a bad one.
That's what I'm worried
about. But you need to start with a nice piece of meat. And I recommend you look for something labeled USDA Choice or USDA Prime. They're the two upper grades of steaks in the grocery store. Prime is a little hard to find. It used to only go to restaurants, but it's showing up now more and more in specialty butcher shops. It's going to be more expensive, but that's the grade that your great steakhouses are using. So if you want to cook dad a steak that will compete with what's being cooked in the very tip-top steakhouses, you want to go for USDA Prime. The next thing you want to think about is thickness. The cooking technique for a thin steak is different than a cooking technique for a thick steak. We can talk more about that in a little bit, but you want to decide if you want to go for something 1 inch or under, or 1.5 to 2 inches if you can. The other thing is, what cut do you want? Flank steak, for example, is a really tasty cut, but it's a tough cut, and you've got to cook it exactly right, and you've got to slice it properly across the grain. But it's a beautiful steak, and it's relatively inexpensive. The more expensive steaks are the ribeyes, but that's what you're going to most likely get in most steakhouses. It comes from the muscle that runs right alongside the spine of the back of the animal. It's called the longissimus dorsi, and you have two of them. They start at your neck and run to your hip, and it's that big, long muscle. And they don't work very hard. They're very tender and juicy, and they have a lot of marbling. And the marbling is that little lacy fat that runs through the muscle, and that's a lot of flavor. The fat on the outside of the steak cannot penetrate. A steak is 75% water. Fat is oil. Oil and water don't mix. What's on the outside cannot get inside. It's what's inside that matters.
Now, again, if I'm looking to make that, I'm trying to get a restaurant quality grilling experience. I want to make sure I get the absolute best. On your website, you write and say, you know, go to a butcher and give them really precise instructions. Ask what they have. They don't mind if I do that, and I'm asking for a cut just to this thickness, and I want this and this. That's all cool with them?
Yeah, well, you know, they are in the business of helping you have a great experience so you come back. You know, I like to say that knowing your butcher is just as good as knowing your stockbroker, maybe better. The head butcher in a grocery store is usually there in the morning when the trucks come in, so they get there fairly early usually, and then they go home fairly early in the afternoon. So don't show up at 5 o'clock and expect to see the head butcher. But if you tell them that you would like 1.5 inch thick USDA Prime or Top Choice. USDA Choice is a good grade, but Top Choice is the more marbled. It's just this side of Prime. They'll get it for you. Or, you know, you can order from most butchers. A lot of people don't know this, but if you know you want a special steak, like a Prime steak, and your butcher or your grocer doesn't normally carry Prime because it's expensive, go in there on a Monday if you're going to serve it on Friday or Sunday and say, can you order for me 2.5 inch ribeyes USDA Prime? Chances are they can.
Talking to Meathead Goldwyn, author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. incoming member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame. It's Food Friday. He is helping us to choose and grill awesome steak. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lauren is with us in Franklin. Lauren, hi.
Hi there. So my question is about skirt steak. It is a cut of steak that, from what I understand, is very similar to flank steak, which you just mentioned. I'm a beginner griller, and I've had luck with this one, but I'm not having luck finding skirt steak. I have been on a never-ending quest to find it, and I cannot find it in any grocery store. And I'm wondering, what's the difference between, you know, skirt and flank? Can I substitute flank? Is there really much of a difference? I don't know what part of the cow it comes from, and yeah, where both would I find this?
Both of them come from the belly area, the underside of the animal. And skirt steak is skinnier than flank steak. And I'm shocked you can't find it because it is the core of a lot of Mexican cooking. So perhaps if you can't find it in your neighborhood grocery, maybe because there's not enough Latinos in your neighborhood, you might want to go to a grocery that caters to Mexicans, because you will certainly find skirt steaks there. It's a very thin, chewy steak, and it's very tricky to cook. The secret to a great steak, a great tasting steak, is a nice dark brown crust or an exterior, and you get that from high temperature. But the best ones are pink or red in the center. Medium rare is 130 to 135 degrees in the middle. And with a really skinny steak, it's really hard to do that. You can get a good dark crust, but by the time you've got it, it's overcooked in the center. So the trick to cooking skirt steak is give it all she's got, Scotty. Get as high a temp as you can and grill it really hot and fast. A thick steak, we'll talk about in a minute, but you want to cook a thick steak like a ribeye a little differently.
Thanks for that call, Lauren. Great question. Let's cook that thick steak now. And Meathead, you have sold me for many things that I grill on, you know, don't sear first and then cook. Mm-hmm. Cook low first and then sear. The reverse sear, I think, is what you converted me to. Is that what we want to do with our thick cut of good steak?
You see it coming, don't you? Yeah. Yeah, here's the theory. This is, and you know, a lot of books tell you sear first. Whether you're cooking indoors or outdoors. Let's do a little physics here. It's useful to think of it as energy, not heat. When you put a piece of meat above flame or glowing coals, you're pounding the underside of that meat with energy. And it's going to cook the surface of that steak. But the energy itself doesn't penetrate the meat. It can't. Remember, it's 75% water, and water is a great insulator. What happens is it builds up energy in the surface of the meat, and that's like a capacitor. And it stores that energy, and it slowly works its way down towards the center. So the outside of the meat cooks the inside of the meat, not the charcoal or the gas flame. So if you put meat right over hot flame, you're going to get a beautiful dark exterior. But then you're going to get a layer of brown just below the surface, then a layer of tan, then a layer of pink. And if you like it medium rare, which is 130 to 135, and that's where it's most tender and most juicy, it'll be about a half of the interior will be medium rare. But if you take it and you divide your grill in half, and this is called two-zone cooking, and it's the keystone of great grilling. And you have all the heat on one side. If you got a gas grill, you turn on the burners on one side and leave the burners on the other side off. And it's like if you walk outside on a hot, sunny day, and the sun beats down on the back of your neck, it's hot. You step into the shade, it's the same hot, sunny day, but you're a lot cooler. And that's because you've walked away from the direct ultraviolet energy. Well, a grill has infrared energy. It's a little different on the scale of radiation, but it's still radiation. And you're going to move from the direct infrared side to the side where the burner is off. Or if you've got charcoal, you're going to push all the charcoal to one side, and the other side, there's no charcoal. Over there, you're in the shade. and the steak will warm gently. And you do this for a thick steak, not for a skirt steak. The steak will warm gently, and it'll be even temperature top to bottom. It'll take longer, and when it's almost done, then you move it to the infrared side, that really radiant heat side, and you give it all she's got there. You lift the lid, and so you flip it. And again, this goes against everything you've been told. They tell you to put the steak down and don't flip it. Well, when you do that, the energy builds up, and it starts working its way to the center. But if you flip it, the energy that's stored in the surface will bleed off into the atmosphere. So now you're searing and building the crust, the bark, the outside. And what happens there is you're getting a chemical reaction. The energy is changing the structure of the protein and the amino acids and any of the reducing sugars in there. And it turns it dark brown. And that's flavor. So you treat the inside by cooking it on the indirect in the shade, and then you treat the outside at the end of the cook over direct infrared energy, and you've got the perfect steak.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com. He is teaching us about steak, how to pick them out, the best ways to grill them, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to cut or technique that you like to use, or do you have a question? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com and incoming member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame, about how to get the most out of any cut of steak on the grill. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Philip is with us in Neenah. Philip, hello.
Hi. I'm a big fan of trying cuts of steak not common to the U.S. One cut I like is picanha from Brazil. I was wondering if your guest had any recommendations for other popular cuts of steak outside of the U.S.
Boy, as soon as you said other cuts, the first thing that came to my mind was the picanha. What a great cut that is. And one of the secrets to the picanha, people, if you've ever eaten in a Brazilian steakhouse, you've seen this. It comes to you on that long sword, kind of curved in a C shape. And it's got a thick layer of fat on there. When you cut it, do you leave your fat on?
Yeah, I cut it with like a strip, so it's like mostly meat, but then the tip is like fat. It's great.
Right. It has some of the most tender and delicious fat. I know it may gross a lot of people out. Normally, you cut the fat off and discard most of it. But the picanha has a really succulent, buttery fat, and it's really quite good. There's a cut that comes from the shoulder called the flat iron, very tender. It has a strip of gristle down the middle, which is inedible, but you work around that. That's a nice cut. It's about 1 to 3/4 inch thick, so you want to cook that hot and fast. And it's not a rare steak, but I got to put in a good word for flank steaks. I just love them. They're just so flavorful, and it's a much cheaper cut than ribeye. It comes from the belly. It's thicker than the other belly cuts, but it cooks fairly quickly. You also want to cook that hot and fast, not the reverse sear I talked about. In fact, I have a fun technique. If you go to youtube.com/AmazingRibs and look at my video of cooking flank steak. I've got a couple of grapevines that grow on my backyard, and I take the cuttings and I let them dry out for a few months, and I cram them into my Weber kettle, light them, and you get like a 6-foot flame. It's really awesome. And they burn down to embers, but they cook. The embers are about 1,000 degrees. And boy, searing a steak over grape wood embers, it's just wonderful, and it cooks really fast, gets a great dark sear, tender and juicy. The trick to flank steak is you got to notice that the grain is running from one end to the other, and you have to cut across the grain to make it tenderer to chew.
Thanks a lot for that call, Philip. Sounds like you have a project on your hand. Hope you have some grapevines handy. Let's go to Scott now in Windsor. Scott, hi.
Hi, I just want to put in a pitch for sous vide or sous vide preparation of steaks and other meats for your grill. It's French for under glass or under vacuum.
Under vacum. It's a it's called sous vide.
We've talked about this before. Remind us how that works, though.
Yeah, sous vide's a really wonderful concept. You know, if you put meat on a grill, the coals are putting out all this infrared energy, and it's really hot. You know, it's 700, 800 degrees. But if your target is 130 to 135, which is medium rare, where it is most tender and most juicy, to get there really easy, you slip it into a Ziploc bag, and you slide the bag into water so that the water pushes all the air out. You seal the bag, or you can use a vacuum sealer. And then you get this tube. It's like an old-fashioned flashlight, and it's a heater with a blower in it. And you stick it in a bucket of water, and you drop the steak in there, and you can set it digitally with your smartphone or buttons on the machine, and it goes right to 130, and it stays there. And your steak will cook up to 130, but it can't go to 131 because that's the temperature of the water. So you can't overcook, and it can hold like that for hours. So it's a great way if you've got a whole bunch of people to coming over. You need to cook 12 steaks to exactly medium rare. You bag them into the sous vide machine, set it for 130, walk away for 4 or 5 hours, and then when they come, you take them out of the bag. Now, they're in the bag. They haven't been seared, so they're butt ugly. They're tan. And now you throw it on the grill as hot as you can get it or into a really hot cast iron pan, and you give it that dark Maillard reaction crust, and it's great technique. And I call it sous vide Q. And you can even move it to the smoker if you want. And I've got a whole article. In fact, I have an ebook on Amazon called Sous Vide Q Made Easy, and it describes the whole sous vide process and how to use the grill and the smoker. And the book's $3.99 on Amazon, for crying out loud. So it's a really fun technique, a little high tech, but the beauty is you know, you set it and forget it and walk away.
Scott, thanks for that call. Meathead, I want to take a minute to talk about salt on our steak when we're prepping it. How much do we have to use it? Do we need to use it? What do you think?
You know, salt is the magic rock. Salt is unlike any other herb and spice on your spice rack. It's a very simple molecule, sodium chloride, sodium and chloride, two little atoms. And when they get on the steak or whatever else you're cooking, they get wet and they get electrified, they ionized. They can actually move deep into meat or vegetables, whatever you're serving. They can move deep. Sugar, pepper, garlic, they're massive molecules. Your basic sugar molecule is 23 atoms. They cannot go past the surface. Now, I know a lot of you think, when I marinate it or when I put all these spice rubs and everything. No, they're a surface-only treatment. And you can prove this by cooking something like a pork loin or a turkey breast. Soak it for a week in whatever marinade you want, throw it on the grill, and cut it in half and look in the center, and you will not see any change. In fact, I've done this with green dye. And the green dye, 16th to an eighth of an inch penetration, that's all. But salt does wonders. Salt gets deep in there, and it alters the shapes of the proteins. It's called denaturing the proteins. But it helps the protein hold on to moisture. So it's actually a moisture enhancer. The other thing that salt does is it amplifies the flavor. It turns it up to 11 and it doesn't alter the flavor. Garlic alters the flavor.
That's
pepper
a good place to leave it. Thanks to Meathead Goldwyn, member of the 2021 class of inductees into the Barbecue Hall of Fame. He joined us for Food Friday to talk about grilling with steak. Coming up Monday on Central Time, COVID numbers are way down in the U.S. That's good news. We'll look back at the early days of the crisis, and we're going to ask you to share some of your memories from those early days. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. When you picture spacecraft, whether real-world satellites and space stations or interstellar craft from the worlds of science fiction, there's a good chance you picture them being made of some really high-tech, fancy material. Advanced plastics, high-tech carbon fiber, obscure metallic alloys. All looks really fancy and shiny. But one cutting-edge experiment going on right now in the real world is going to make satellites out of plywood. As reported by NPR, the European Space Agency plans to launch an experimental satellite made out of plywood later this year. The idea came from the owner of a company in Finland that makes wooden replicas of existing CubeSat satellites and thought, hey, plywood's tough. Let's try it in the real thing. Now, to be clear, this is not exactly the same plywood that your $40 bookshelf is made out of. It's a more durable variety. It goes through a special drying process. Evidently, moisture is a bad thing to have in orbit. If it works, plywood offers some advantages. It's cheap, it's light, and when it re-enters orbit, it's going to burn up completely instead of dropping debris planet-side. Gotta like that. I'm just picturing the assembly instructions as a knockoff IKEA manual. Insert 1-inch wood screw, A, into guidance fin, G, and tighten with Phillips head screwdriver. What could go wrong? Just don't let me to put them together. Space news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.